What is truth? Pontius Pilate asked Jesus. A good question. Here's another. Why does it matter? This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. As George Weigel's biography of St. John Paul II makes clear, even as a young man, Karol Wojtyła had a passionate concern for truth. In his theological and philosophical studies, the question, what is truth, was utmost in his mind, along with the question of how do we communicate the truth to others. And truth became a theme of his pontificate. 25 years ago, last month, on August 6, 1993, the Feast of the Transfiguration, John Paul promulgated the encyclical Veritatis Splendor, the splendor of truth. What he had to say needed to be heard 25 years ago, and needs to be heard with even greater urgency today. In this week's podcast, Dr. Jeremy Holmes explains the need for the encyclical, the arguments St. John Paul made, and some of the errors he addressed. Next week, Dr. Kent Lisnowski will look into a particular concern in the encyclical, the question of conscience. And so, we begin with Dr. Holmes. Dr. Holmes, St. John Paul II stated his purpose in the beginning of the encyclical clearly. He wrote, "The specific purpose of the present encyclical is this, to set forth, with regard to the problems being discussed, the principles of a moral teaching based upon sacred scripture and the living apostolic tradition, and at the same time to shed light on the presuppositions and consequences of the dissent which that teaching has met." What were the problems and the presuppositions? Why did he write this?
He identifies two broad-brush problems. One is the theory of the fundamental option. This would be to say that deep down at your core, you fundamentally choose for good or for evil. You fundamentally choose for God or for something else. And all the acts you do day to day occur towards the surface and don't define who you are. So, for example, if you have a brief affair with the school secretary, that does not necessarily mean that you have chosen against God, because it may not have, it doesn't mean that you are fundamentally choosing a different option in life, fundamentally changing your self-definition. So that was one idea that John Paul wanted to respond to. Another theory that he wanted to respond to, he identifies with various names, consequentialism or proportionalism or teleologism. This moral theory or theories would see the morality of an act as depending on the final situation it creates. So, for example, if I'm in a situation where either 10 people will die or I could shoot one guy in the head, then it may be that the moral thing is to shoot one guy in the head, because I thereby create a situation where 10 people, or say 9 more people, are alive than would have been otherwise. So the final situation is better, so I need to choose that situation. That was another kind of moral theory that he was responding to, and he sees both theories as sharing one feature in common. In both of them, concrete human actions are treated as physical events. So if I shoot that guy in the head, then the concrete human action is treated as something like, I raise my hand, my finger tightens around the trigger, the gun goes off, the man falls over, right? There's this series of physical events unfolding. And that whole physical event that is the concrete action is neither moral nor immoral. Right, it's in the fundamental option theory that the morality comes in at a much deeper level in terms of the core, my core decision about life. And the consequentialism theory, the morality really depends on the situation that will be created. But the human act itself is seen as a kind of unfolding of physical activities that can't be defined as good or evil. And so on either the fundamental option theory or consequentialism, you can't identify a certain kind of act and say, that kind of act is always wrong. In other words, you can't really have the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm. And that would be a bad thing.
This is getting away from our biblical basis. And so John Paul is going to urge a return to the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas and a return to a philosophy that is capable of being biblically rooted, of being consonant with what Scripture is giving us. So that any philosophy that ends up saying there is no moral absolute, there is no way that you can say that this kind of action is always wrong, then as a Catholic we're going to have a problem.
Now, in general terms, how does he argue for his position? How does he answer those two?
He goes after the thing they have in common. That is, he points out that all of these theories, no matter what their diversity, all of them look at a human act from a third-person perspective. They all analyze, for example, the deed of murder from the point of view of an observer outside the murderer, watching him do it and seeing his physical actions as he does it, and then trying to figure out whether that was morally good or bad. He says there's the essential problem. He says that in order to be able to grasp the object of an act which specifies that act morally, it is therefore necessary to place oneself in the perspective of the acting person. Or to put it in other words, you can't analyze a deed from a third-person perspective. You can only analyze the morality of an action from a first-person perspective. As long as what you're looking at is simply an unfolding of physical events, you're not thinking of a human action, because a human action is one that is rational and intentional. So to understand what is murder, it's not enough to see a certain set of physical actions the way an outside observer would. You have to see those actions from the perspective of the person doing them. That is, you have to see, how do these actions present themselves to reason? How are these actions intended? And then you'll be able to distinguish things like capital punishment and a soldier in combat from things like murder, where the physical actions may be similar or indistinguishable, but the moral action is in a completely different species.
Now, one of the themes of the encyclical is the interaction between freedom and truth. For most people, today at least, moral truth claims diminish freedom. If you claim to know the right from wrong with certainty, you are oppressing me. And so freedom is equated with moral relativism. For John Paul, it was just the other way around. Freedom is impossible without truth. Moral relativism always increases bondage, not freedom. Explain that to us.
Yes, he says that obedience to God is not, as some would believe, a heteronomy, a law from someone else. As if the moral life were subject to the will of something all-powerful, absolute, extraneous to man, and intolerant of his freedom. You know, exactly what you're saying, that the moral law is not some kind of externally imposed code that now, oh, we're constrained to follow. It's the moral law is the very truth of our own being. The moral law is our grasping what we are, and therefore what is good for us to do. So in fact, the immoral is that which is finally opposed to the good of man. And the moral is that which is in line with and promotes the good of man. So just as when we, in the intellectual realm, you say in the realm of philosophizing about, you know, beings and natures and so on, there are certain first self-evident principles that we can start from to build our arguments. So in the moral life, there's a certain set of principles that are immediately evident to us just from the fact that we are human. And we're looking out from within our humanity at what we're going to do. And he said, those principles, that's the natural law. The natural law is nothing other, really, than reason itself. The light of reason is the natural law. So when we obey the natural law, what we're actually doing is being what we are, acting in accord with what is in fact good for us, what is built into us as rational creatures, rather than following an outside code. So the moral law would be less analogous to a dictator imposing his fiat on the people, more analogous to the manual you get with your car that says to change the oil every 6,000 miles. Mm-hmm. And you might be resentful of that. I was planning a 10,000 mile trip. I don't want to pause at 6,000 miles and change the oil. How dare you impose? But the manual is just telling you, given what your car is and how it works, this is what's good for it. And the moral law is like that for human beings. Given what we are and how we work, this is what's good for us.
Now, does he also address the whole issue of there is a human nature? In other words, we are a certain kind of thing. These other moral philosophies, in a sense, posit that there is no human nature.
Yes. The entire encyclical is themed under this title, right? The splendor of truth. He chooses that phrase because he sees God as truth itself. And our nature as rational beings as a reflection of that truth, the participation in that first truth.
Well, we've been teaching Genesis together. We're made in God's image.
Right. And in a way, you could say this entire encyclical is an unpacking of that idea that we are made in God's image. Because God is pure light, pure truth, then we, made in His image, the truth also shines within us in the light of reason itself. And that fact is what means there is a moral law. If we did not have the splendor of truth within us, then there would be no moral law. We would be like plants and animals.
And animals just acting out of our impulses.
Yeah, there would be no seeing of what is good for me and seeing of what is bad for me and choosing one or the other. Right? To act immorally, John Paul is saying, is the same thing as to act irrationally. To be a rational creature, to have the splendor of truth within you, and then to act against that truth, that's immorality.
Well, how then do we know the truth? How do we know that moral truth? I mean, the person who says that we know the moral truth because it brings out good outcomes regardless of the means, and he obviously has a way of trying to know the moral truth, right?
Yes, he's looking to the outcomes. And one of the problems that proportionalism or consequentialism always runs into is that, in fact, it's impossible for us to know in all circumstances what the outcomes will be or what the outcomes of the outcomes will be. What will be the eventual ripple effect of what I do? We can't know that. And if knowing that is a prerequisite to acting morally, then we're all goners. But what we do have is we have right within us that participation in God's truth. We have the splendor of truth in us, that is reason. Because we participate in God's being, then as we bring that participation, that light to bear on what is in front of us, we see the truth of that thing. We see what is in line with that light and what is not in line with that light. So we ultimately know moral truth or any other truth by the fact of being made in God's image. Now, of course, we know from experience that alone often fails us. In our weakness, we choose wrongly and eventually darken our minds, or we have poor teachers and end up in a strange philosophy. And so we do end up needing help from the outside, not only from other human beings, but eventually the final solution is that God himself becomes man. And the splendor of truth in us meets the truth incarnate, and depth speaks to depth. The abyss calls out to the abyss. What we are at root meets the rationality that defines us meets the word itself, and he guides us into all truth.
In Veritatis Splendor, St. John Paul wrote, quote, "No damage must be done to the harmony between faith and life The unity of the church is damaged not only by Christians who reject or distort the truths of faith, but also by those who disregard the moral obligations to which they are called by the gospel. Close quote. Next week, we'll talk about how those moral obligations are related to conscience. Join us, or maybe listen with a group, as an introduction to reading and discussing Veritatis Splendor. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkwich.